Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And on this week's New Statesman podcast...
We don't talk about Brexit. That's a lie.
We do talk about the bits of the public realm that are falling apart.
And I interview John Lanchester, author of The Wall. Well, if you don't want to hear about Brexit, then you've come to the wrong place, because unfortunately it enters now its 9 billionth year. Stephen, I think the most useful thing that we can do, apart from ending this all in the sweet release of death, is talk people through what are going to happen with the amendments that are coming down next week. So tell me about it. The bill is coming back to the House. This is Plan B, which appears to be Plan A in a funny moustache.
Yeah, so
Theresa May's deal. It's coming back to the House on Monday?
Yeah, on Monday, and the votes are on Tuesday night again. So
what is the difference between her Plan A and Plan B?
So I guess actually the difference is Plan A was her saying, look, actually the backstop is good, right?
Yeah.
That was the line that, you know, Geoffrey Cox actually did a very
That's
good fist
General,
of arguing.
Right? Yeah.
Michael Gove argued, and she argued. Now she's gone, oh, I've listened to you, and actually I'm going to go and renegotiate the backstop, which is...
But she hasn't got time to renegotiate it by Monday.
And also so it's impossible, it's not going to happen.
And just to explain the backstop for anybody who's blessedly been living under a rock, it's the idea that if we don't agree a trade deal within the time specified in the implementation period / transition period, then a kind of insurance policy activates that keeps the entire UK in the customs union?
Well, it keeps the entirety of the United Kingdom in the customs and regulatory orbit of the EU, with a greater number of Northern Ireland specific protocols, but a number of UK wide ones. Although, yeah, there are many weird things about it. But actually, the big victory of the backstop from a Brexiteer perspective is it allows you to maintain the customs and regulatory alignment, which allows you not to have a hard border on the island of Ireland, which has been, you know, like the major ask of both governing parties since, at the absolute latest, the Downing Street Declaration, and at the earliest, the Anglo-Irish Agreement in 85. But it also allows you to preserve that, while if you want to have a Canada-style Brexit, you can just go, right, we'll have a customs border in the Irish Sea. And
this is where the DUP are upset, right? Because the DUP know that very quickly in the future they could be chucked under the bus, and there could in fact be a different treatment for Northern Ireland than from the rest of the UK, which is kind of not really their thang. Okay, so she comes back and says, the backstop is bad. I will definitely have a word with Michel Barnier, see if we can sort that bad boy out. Mm. That's going to convince, I'm going to say, no one.
Yeah, no, I mean, there is no negotiable form of words that will... There's nothing which will meet the demands of the DUP, and a number of Conservative MPs, basically, they don't... I'm not saying this in a pejorative way, right? They will cheerfully admit, and they don't themselves understand what the, like, legal do's and don'ts are, but if Nigel Dodd stands up and goes, this is not okay, they will not vote for it. So she's not going to get that. However, the crucial thing is this motion is amendable, and the assumption is that the Commons will amend it in a variety of ways, which will slightly illuminate the will of the House.
Right, so people have put down a series of amendments. The Speaker then gets to choose which ones he wants to have votes on. Let's go through. So Dominic Grieve, formerly kind of quite dry-looking lawyerly type, now recast as breathless Remainer advocate, His original amendment, which was the idea that you had to get five MPs from five parties, 10 at least MPs from each of five parties, totaling 300 in total, and then at that point you would be able to... Remind me what happens, because then at that point, you would then at that point be able to have backbench business run before government business, i.e. the backbenchers could control the legislative timetable.
Yeah.
He's now changed it so that that would need a majority,
yeah.
But nonetheless it's seen as being like the government has always run the Commons business. It gave opposition day debates to the opposition to do it. You had other people were allowed backbench bills committee put forward backbench bills. But this would be a significant transfer of power away from the executive towards backbenchers, and therefore is the most sort of scary and radical of the amendments. Is that right? Have I got that right?
Yeah, those are the kind of ones that matter, right? You've got, the very limited amendment put forward by Yvette Cooper, which might actually pass, partly because it's quite limited.
So that is, if we look like by the end of February that the Commons hasn't agreed a deal, that mandates Theresa May to go back to Brussels and ask for, she can't demand, she can only ask for an extension to the Article 50 process until the end of the year?
Yeah.
Which the EU has sort of actually, after saying, well, you can only have until July because of the elections, now seems to have slightly softened on the basis they think we're in a right old pickle.
So basically, although notionally the thing people have said repeatedly is, look, you can only get an extension if there is some kind of if you're planning to have some kind of electoral event, like, you know, another referendum or an election, there's been a kind of change in mood of kind of, as ridiculous as it is that MPs may ask, okay, can we just have some more time to think? No one wants a no-deal exit, so it would almost certainly be granted, although there would also almost certainly be further asks about Gibraltar and other sort of individual demands of member states that might be quite painful for the UK, but yeah, an extension would be doable. The kind of the bigger question, right, is one, although the Cooper Amendment will probably pass...
Because Labour will probably whip in favour of it.
I think there are kind of weirdly, there are two successes of the People's Vote campaign. The first is that they have managed to keep this proposition, which has no credible path to a parliamentary majority.
The concept of a people's vote. Or the concept of a second referendum. I think the first victory is calling it a people's vote. Yeah. Right, yeah.
Then they have managed to kind of keep this concept semi-alive, despite the fact that its path to passage has always been, you know, kind of wafer thin at best.
Yeah.
The second is, and I think this one is more harmful, is that they have successfully created this meme that there is a button that Theresa May can press called Tory MPs and a button that Jeremy Corbyn can press marked Labour MPs. Because so the shadow cabinet was basically told, yeah, we are going to whip in favour of this on Monday. The reason why in public they're still doing this kind of like, well, you know...
Who can say what we'll do? We're against no-deal Brexit, but we're not committing ourselves.
We think this is good, but is one. So the other amendment which matters, because it's certain to vote on because it's been put down by the leader of the opposition, is Jeremy Corbyn's amendment, which basically calls for indicative votes on a variety of Brexit deals and calls on the government to keep open the idea then there should be a final vote on whatever is negotiated.
Would those be free votes, those indicative votes?
Well, how those votes would be whipped on would be the choice of Theresa May, Jeremy Corbyn, Vince Cable and Ian Blackford / Nicola Sturgeon, and also, I guess, Liz Saville Roberts. But, you know, crucially, the thing about that amendment, which has been very carefully written in order to minimise... Well, so from the Labour leadership, to maximise the amount in which they can say to Remainers, look, we tried, and to minimise the amount to which they can then actually have to be in a position where they are supporting a second vote. As readers of my free morning email will know, on Monday I went, oh, this is actually quite clever from their perspective. Now, the interesting thing is that although it has contained the level of eruption from Remainers, right, so it has actually worked in that perspective, a number of Labour MPs are quite nervous, even about Labour's amendment.
Did I see a shadow minister saying they would resign from the shadow cabinet if there was any move towards a people's vote?
Yeah, so Melanie On is kind of the latest person to go public with that. She's very much in kind of what I would, if you were to... Because obviously, right, people threaten to resign all the time, and they often don't when things happen. However, so basically there are two groups of people in the shadow cabinet who say, if we do this, I'll resign. there are, you know, committed supporters of Brexit for kind of left-wing reasons, who I actually think are bluffing, because they mostly wouldn't do that to Corbyn. Although equally, the reason why I think it's unlikely they'll be put in that position is I don't think he would do it to
them. His mates, yeah.
The people who I actually think are much more believable are, you know, people like Melanie Olin, who voted for, you know, Yvette Cooper in 2015, who resigned from the front bench in 2016, you know, is someone in a very Leavey marginal seat and is much, much less inclined, therefore, to go, oh, well, I can't embarrass my close political ally. People like her, of whom there are many on the front bench, are the ones who actually should spook the leadership in terms of that threat being true. The reason why people like her are going to start coming out more and more is that, despite the fact that, of course, you know, anyone who has, you know, read almost anything I have written on this subject since, you know, I don't know how long, knows that, you know, Yvonne Fothergill exists. She's a real Labour MP. I didn't just make her up to upset, like...
The name does sound a bit like you made her up.
Yeah, but yeah, so the EEA rebels do exist, and they are a present reason why it is very difficult to work out how, even with a Labour whip, you get a second referendum, or to be honest, even Norway Plus is a difficult ask. But lots of those MPs have been very happy to sit under the umbrella of, oh, well, you know, I think it's important that we do what Jeremy says. Because even though many of them have constituencies where they have loads of Leave voters and their constituency surgeries, people come up to them and say, you know, if you block Brexit, I will never vote for you again. Most of them still have party memberships that look like the party membership. Like, the social profile of a Labour Party member doesn't really change, and indeed of any party member, doesn't really change depending on where in the country you are. So you still have a very remaining activist base. And lots of Labour MPs have been quite willing until now to hide behind the fact that Corbyn wants Brexit and is popular with Labour members. What you're going to start to see, I think, now, is some of those people are going to basically feel that they can't rely only on the leadership being their water carrier, and they're going to have to start. So, you know, we had with the EEA amendment that letter from what Gareth Snell, Gloria De Piero, and AN Other basically going, hey Jeremy, I'd like you to know I'm a real fan of your work on this Brexit thing. And there will be more of that type of thing. And if those people start to worry, then even the Cooper amendment, which extends, is too dangerous for them, then I imagine that the Labour leadership may at the 11th hour go, you know, we'll whip to abstain, or we'll whip. I mean, basically, the problem is I can't really work out what they can do that doesn't cause bits to fall off, particularly seeing as Downing Street is pushing very hard and its media proxies are repeating this idea that the Cooper Amendment is about stopping Brexit.
Right, which I think is the problem, isn't it? Because what that does is it takes the default away from being no deal from March. Well, I mean, it moves it on to the end of the year. And therefore, it removes Theresa May's prime negotiating strategy, which is to say it's my deal or no deal, and therefore you should vote for my deal. So I can see why they just think if they hold their nerve. Who do you think is going to blink first? Do you think that Theresa May is just going to take it right down to the wire? She doesn't seem to have done any kind of compromising at all. And the question of whether or not Corbyn should have gone in to talk to her, I don't think whether or not he had gone in, whether or not that would have been a good move, I don't think he would have got anything out of her.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whether or not Corbyn should have gone in, I think, depends entirely on two questions to which the answer is insufficient data, come back later, as it were. The first is, although we know that voters love the idea in the abstract of parties voting together, although they tend to get really annoyed with parties when they actually do it. So we know that it is unpopular that he has not gone. We don't know if that unpopularity will ever actually matter, because... You know, so basically, it depends on two unanswerable questions. One, will there be an early election? Two, in that early election, will Theresa May be able to successfully and effectively weaponise him not turning up without preconditions?
I think, well, I mean, who knows, because the Tory party is sometimes a baffling mystery to me. But I think going, you'll meet Raed Salah, you'll meet Hamas, and you won't meet Theresa May is a fairly decent attack line.
It's a decent attack line in that it's a good attack line, but do people care?
Right, that's the thing. But I also wouldn't put it past the Tory. I mean, it was kind of thing that probably sounds great on, you know, Politics Live, but whether or not you can put it in a leaflet or a Facebook ad is a larger question. Although I guess you could build it into a narrative. They might try and build it into a narrative that Jeremy Corbyn's kind of stubborn and unreasonable, but then people are going to go, I'm going to introduce you to Theresa May.
Well, I mean, the thing is, right, so yeah, the Conservatives clearly believe, and the Labour Party clearly agrees with them, that the position that the Conservatives would like to be in any election is being able to go, they're blocking Brexit. And so I think the question is whether or not you can use him not meeting with her as a way to prosecute that wider, more electorally damaging argument. I'm not convinced that you can, not least because clearly Theresa May is no longer convinced that she can. She's only relatively recently, but has reluctantly started to abandon going the "you're blocking Brexit" to a kind of much more vague "you can't be pinned down on anything." So basically, in terms of who will blink first, I still think that the people who are more likely to blink are the various kind of soft Brexit to pro-Remain tribes. Because ultimately, the people who want a deal all believe... You know,
which leads to what outcome?
People voting for Theresa May's deal. Because, like, ultimately, although it is likely that, you know...
I kind of agree with you, but I kind of think we might cycle through an extension, an election first, right?
I think this...
It's in a lot of people's interest, isn't it, to make it seem like this is the thing they did after they literally exhausted every other option.
Yeah, I mean, I also think lots of people don't want that to be their option. But a lot of the conversations I've had this week have been, you know, with Lib Dem MPs and Labour MPs who all of essentially to a man and to a woman do not want to pass Theresa May's deal. They then disagree with what they want in its place, but they also all agree, with the exception of Kate Hoey, they are unified on not wanting no deal. And the thing, they will go, "Well, what do you think is going to happen?" And then I will make myself deeply unpopular by saying, I think that, you know, if you can't get her to take no deal off the table in a permanent way, and I don't think you do have the numbers to do that, seeing as the Cooper Amendment does not do that, and it probably would not pass if it took the necessary action to do it, I think then at some point you will cave. And although some of them get very angry, most of them kind of go, "Yeah, to be honest, I think that too."
That was the standout line for me from your morning emails this week, is that if you can't pass, like, the Grieve Amendment, if that is the thing that people are not willing to put their names to because they're so worried about what it means for them electorally and their constituencies, any thought of avoiding either no deal or Theresa May's deal kind of goes up in smoke, because ultimately, if MPs can kind of complain about it all they want, but unless they're willing to actively block no deal or Theresa May's deal and find another alternative, they're not going to get anywhere. Well, we will be back. I won't be here next week. I'll be finishing off my book. So have fun with the vote, Stephen. That's all I can say. Don't have too much fun, obviously.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Now it's time for a section we like to call
"You Ask Us."
Well, we've got lots of questions, but the question which most spoke to us was, look, what else is going on in public policy other than Brexit?
Yeah, I think it's really important. We finally had some sights of the domestic abuse bill, which has got some interesting stuff in it. It's not got as much in it as I would hope for migrant women, people with no recourse to public funds, which has been a really big problem in the sector. It's got one really, in my opinion, totally bonkers thing in it, which is the idea that you're going to give lie detector tests to perpetrators, domestic violence perpetrators, when they come out of prison. And I was like, at what point did we accept that lie detectors, like, work rather than just being a little gnome in a box with a thing, scratchy thing going up and down? So I might as well give them sort of phrenology tests.
So there's a plan that someone gets out of prison and they're wired up to, like...
And they're going to go, "Oh, you've definitely given up the old domestic violence." And if they go yes, and then it shows up no. I don't know what's going to happen at that point. It's just bonkers. Have you found anything else similarly bonkers?
So, I mean, to be honest, with the domestic abuse bill, I was just astonished that, you know, meaningful legislation about something that wasn't Brexit had somehow emerged from the government. It was even more unnerving to me because they actually did do a very good job politically with the rollout. It was, you know, like living in an era led by a very different political leadership than the one we currently have. So I think there are three other interesting things. One, of course, is the ongoing attempts by Amber Rudd to effectively sand off the politically
toxic
bits of universal credit. The problem is, it is like, you know, the Mean Girls joke of, you know, the limit does not exist, right? There is actually no non-politically damaging bit of universal credit, because universal credit is a really bad idea.
A badly designed system that takes money away from people.
Yeah, but it is nonetheless... So, yeah, I kind of think the kind of interesting part is yeah, basically every so often it goes quiet and she announces one of the more semi-popular bits. And then when there's a big crisis, there's another announcement which is like, by the way, we're either still doing this or we're sanding off another edge of it. And then the other kind of, you know, sort of unexploded slash about to explode landmine in the DWP brief is sleep-ins. This is this weird thing which, for basically since the introduction of the minimum wage, if you are a carer who is either living permanently or you're not permanent, you are paid differently in the hours in which you are notionally asleep to the hours in which you are awake. Of course, the problem with this is, one, you are away from home, you know, not seeing
on
your
call,
loved ones
effectively.
On call. You are mostly not sleeping the whole 6 hours through. And what happened then was, is that the High Court basically went, no, of course these people need to be paid the minimum wage, the full, you know, need to be paid the full amount. In, you know, you can't have this weird thing where you claim they should be paid less in these hours. A bunch of the kind of third sector and private sector organisations which provide most of our care, because most care is done on a commissioning basis, basically then turned around and gone, well, okay, but we don't have any money to do that, so we're probably going to just fold. This then went to the High Court, to the Court of Appeal, which unexpectedly, yeah, went, no, actually, we don't think you do need to pay this. It now looks likely to go back to the Supreme Court, where it is generally expected by both defendants and plaintiffs then they will go, no, of course you should pay. In my view, obviously, that is the right verdict. However, the government is at that point going to have to find a non-trivial amount of money to give to care providers. Yeah, it's like the definition of kind of a red warning light than a government that wasn't like hopelessly divided and didn't have a civil service and was, you know, fully given over to doing Brexit would probably have like done a bit more on. They had an emergency infusion of money at one point. I mean, this is the thing, right?
There are so many red warning lights on the government's dashboard, though. I mean, schools, Anoush's written about in this week's magazine, about, you know, schools that are asking people to bring in, you know, lunches for, you know, like their own toilet paper and stuff like that. I mean, and that was an undercover thing, I think, at the last election, the way that school funding, you know, every school could kind of go, you're going to lose this much per pupil. Is that what you want, parents? YN. That, as you say, there's all loads of the DWP brief that I just think is just a kind of howling nightmare. The housing issue is double plus ungood, right? The homelessness crisis still goes on. I walked past four people outside our offices this morning in sleeping bags. Like, and then, you know, as you say, the civil service, bits of it are doing no deal preparation for an outcome that everyone says is absurd, they don't want, should never be allowed to happen, but nonetheless has to be prepared for because there's 60 people in the Tory party who are mental. Stephen.
Yeah, so that's... So basically, outside of Brexit, everything is falling apart.
Yay! And I'm joined by John Lanchester, journalist and author of The Wall, which is out now with Faber. Hello.
Hello.
Dystopian, wall, refugees, climate change. It's a fairly bleak book. What was the seed of it for you? What was the bit that made you want to write this book now?
The seed of it was a recurring dream. I was part of the way through another novel. I still am part of the way. I'm stopped at the exact same point. And I started to have this recurring dream about someone standing guard on his own on a wall in the dark, in the cold, with the water on the other side. And I had it sort of night after night as I was going to sleep. It's like a sort of recurring image. And I started to think about who that person was and what the world they were living in was, and realised quite soon that I was imagining a world after catastrophic climate change. And then that was what turned into the book.
One of the strands that runs through it is the young defender's resentment of the olds. And it's such a fissure in modern politics. We know now that, you know, one of the strongest predictors for voting for Brexit was being over 65. There is this massive chasm where 75% of 18 to 24-year-olds vote Labour and then 75% of 65-plus vote Tory. It has become one of the big dividing lines in British politics. But it's one that's very hard to talk about and take kind of resentment out of that. Is it one that you find interesting to talk about?
It is. You know, it's one of those things that everybody, if you're young and you feel hacked off, you're young and you feel hacked off, and if you have children, as I do, you think about it from the other side, about the kind of world that we're leaving behind and the world we've made and what it's like to be 20 now as opposed to what it's like to be 20 when I was a kid. So it is a thing I think about, and which did feed into the novel. In the novel, it's very... I was trying to imagine what a world after catastrophic climate change would look like in terms of family dynamics, if you had people who grew up in one world and people who grew up in another. And in the book, the narrator, Kavanagh, very directly personalises it. I mean, he essentially blames his parents and their generation for having broken the world that he then has to grow up in.
I think there is a feeling of the fact that people who grew up in with a very strong welfare state, with an NHS that they expected would look after them cradle to grave, with a pension system that they felt would always be there for them, that level of security may have just been a fluke of one generation, right? It may have just been the baby boomer generation just really lucked out in terms of exceeding actuarial, predictions of them. But it does feel like, I think everybody I talk to my age and below feels a lot less steady about the future, and a lot less optimistic, actually.
I think that's true. The one thing I would say, though, is I was 20 in 1982. Unemployment was three times the level it is now. Interest rates were, I think it was something like 15%. So the thing, people can't afford deposits for houses now, but people couldn't afford mortgages then, because 15% is a fearsome interest rate. We had Thatcher and Reagan, and we were worried about the world ending. So it's in hindsight, it looks secure and prosperous, because that's what our adulthood turned out to be. But it didn't at all feel like that. I mean, it properly didn't. And talking about dreams, a very, very common thing in my generation was dreaming, nightly, weekly, really regularly about the end of the world, about nuclear war. So that thing about increased security is partly a trick of perspective.
But do you feel more or less optimistic now than you did then, regardless of whether or not circumstances are different? Because you've spoken before when touring this book about, the Berlin Wall came down in 1989 and now walls are going up.
Yeah,
right?
Which was a thing, an amazingly positive thing that nobody foresaw. I think we're right on a cusp, right on a critical moment now, mainly because of climate. I mean, I think Brexit, for the demographic reasons you mentioned, is obviously... over a period of decades going to be reversed or undone, or we're going to be in some sort of relationship with the EU, irrespective, just because, the numbers tell you that. And Trump will go away sooner rather than later, ideally, and there will be life after both those things. The thing that has a prospect of being irreversible and irrevocable and forever is climate change. And that's the thing that we're on the cusp of. And I think I'm neither optimistic nor pessimistic. I just think this is a critical moment. The IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, report from Katowice last month said that, we could hold the world to 1.5 degree of warming. We've already had 1 degree, it's an extra half a degree on top. And that prevents hundreds of millions of lives. Even the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees is hundreds of millions of people's lives being saved and saved from catastrophic negative impacts. And there's something very encouraging and positive about the fact that most of the world's governments accept that. China, the most populous country in the world, and in some respects the most important for climate change, accept that. All young people accept that. But we are on a knife edge.
But unfortunately, Bolsonaro in Brazil is now wants to amp up deforestation. Donald Trump thinks that the Paris Accords are, a kind of plot against him personally. One of the things I was interested in reading up on you was this idea that you're being a well-disguised semi-immigrant. You've got this interesting background. You grew up in lots of different countries. Do you think that helps to be a writer, if you kind of never quite feel that, always feel that you're slightly from somewhere else, or you've seen lots of different places?
I know lots of writers in the way that dentists know lots of other dentists. I've never met a writer who doesn't have an element of displacement of some sort. It can be gender, class, identity, geography, language, but there's always something. I think in my case, the sort of displaced or placeless thing is to do with, I was born in Germany, my dad was born in Africa, I grew up mainly in Hong Kong, my mum was Irish, we moved around really a lot when I was a kid. So I was at home, and the thing that was always the same was the language. And I think that did feed into, that was one of the things that ended up with me, writing.
The other thing I think is really impressive about your career is you've managed to write about very serious things like climate change, and you've written about Game of Thrones, you've written about video games, you've written in different, you've written fiction and non-fiction and journalism. How do you manage switching between those different forms? And also, do you feel the lure of needing to be super serious? Because I know it can be really hard. We have a thing that happens in this magazine. I remember our publisher once saying to us, the problem is you get comedians to write for the New Statesman because you want them to be funny, right? And then they suddenly go, oh, I'm in the New Statesman, now is the time to air my thoughts on social democracy. And I think there is that temptation when when there are subjects like climate change out there to feel, it feels sort of slightly, I feel bad sometimes about wanting to write about video games.
No, I don't feel that. I find it very important not to have a plan. You know, just write about what you're interested in. That's the most reliable way of keeping things interesting, because if you're interested, the reader's likely to be interested too, and it leads you towards new stuff, leads you towards finding things out. And I really like the process of finding things out. I suppose there's a distinction between my novels and my other stuff. I can write pieces about things that I'm interested in and I follow my interests, but novels tend to come out of a thing that I can't quite get out of my head. I mean, the image that turned into this book being a classic example, it wasn't that I was sort of interested in it, and it wasn't that I wanted to write about the climate. It's just I couldn't get it out of my head any other way.
And in your book, Oops, you took on the financial crisis and tried to kind of make it, which I think is one of the things that is most hard to do in journalism, is tell something, a story of structures and systems rather than a personal story, because it's a lot harder to kind of get interest up for and a kind of handle on. Do you think that we're still, I mean, it is now 11 years on since that, still, how much is that world still shaping on our politics today?
When I was talking about that book, wrote it in 2009, came out in 2010, and going around talking to people about it, meeting people who were thinking about it, it was as if it was still 2008, that everything was stuck in amber. I think that's still true. I think we're still living with the consequences of it. And I think, in a way, what's happened is that the consequences of the credit crunch and the Great Recession are playing out in slow motion in and through crises in democratic politics. But I don't see any sign of a kind of plot twist.
It's odd, isn't it? Because I was thinking about the foundation of Facebook and Twitter, and they still feel weirdly new, like we haven't quite got a grip on how they affect politics. And I think there is that strange sense of the 2010s. A lot happened, you know, God, an exhaustingly large amount of things happened. But in terms of those fundamental structural shifts that you might talk about, you know, like when we talk about the Berlin Wall, like things that what characterise a decade, it does feel a sort of oddly static decade in a weird way.
And it's curious that when we think about it, we very quickly start talking about companies. I mean, that's an odd moment, that instead of talking about democratic politics, the first thing that comes to mind is these giant global corporations affecting everywhere simultaneously. That's genuinely a new thing, I think, or arguably a thing that hasn't happened since the early modern period. And you had, you know, the dominant forces in the world were
the kind of East India Company.
Yeah, exactly, Dutch East India and British East India Company. And it's oddly like that moment again.
Yeah, I think I definitely subscribe to the David Runciman view of, you know, Mark Zuckerberg has more power than Donald Trump, and far less accountability and far less kind of scrutiny on him.
And a kind of, I mean, he's quite a frightening character, Zuckerberg, because when you see him being interviewed, which not that he often does that, but it's not, I mean, he is unaccountable, but he's also clearly unaccountable kind of internally. You know, he won't take any kind of responsibility. He won't really admit the difficulties. His instinctive response to anything is to sort of deny that it's real. You know, it's like the Russian hacking. He's sort of manifestly true, and yet it's his very profound instinct to act as if it's not real.
I think one of the weirdest things I've ever heard him say in one of his very chipper Facebook things was, we're working to safeguard the integrity of the German elections. And you think, you run this thing that ostensibly looks like a place where, you know, my brothers and sisters post pictures of their children going down slides. And how did you get appointed world election monitor?
It's exactly.
Very peculiar.
And your right-hand woman has a conference room whose official title is Only Good News.
I think I'd like one of them, though, to be fair. I can't judge her on that. One final question, which is, you wrote a piece called Is It Art in the LRB, which again must be a decade ago now, following on, I guess, from Roger Ebert's big farrago that he got into about whether or not video games counted as being art. And you wrote about Bioshock, which is a game that's extremely close to my heart, and I replay, like I reread Pride and Prejudice, I replay it every kind of couple of years. Because it does take on the idea, Ayn Rand's idea about a society built only for winners, which happens to be under the sea. And you do get to simultaneously electrocute people and then shoot them in the face with a shotgun, which is not something that I think Ayn Rand's books would be improved considerably were there more of that. But, you know, I remember that game and I remember being so excited about it and thinking this is a genuinely new narrative medium that I'm really interested in. Where's it going to go next? And where it went next was nowhere. Bioshock Infinite's reasonably interesting, tried to make political points about race in America, wasn't as successful in terms of its gameplay mechanic. But, yeah, are you disappointed in video games and where they've gone?
Yeah, massively. I don't play them as much, I don't have as much time. But, you know, one of the things that I was interested in was exactly that point about a new medium. The first new medium, you know, first new mass medium since TV, really, and mass artistic medium. And, you know, it was going to be really interesting to see where it went. And the answer as you say, is sort of nowhere or maybe even possibly slightly backwards. I wonder if it's a thing about being contaminated by money, that the big, as the consoles have got more powerful and, you know, the processing's got more difficult, or the architecture's got more difficult, that it takes a lot of work. You know, it's hundreds of thousands of hours to code those games. So that means that the games have to have a big enough budget to support it. So that means that the games tend to be sequels and franchises and known things, in the way that, you know, the kind of logic of the Hollywood blockbuster has colonized video games very quickly and very, you know, very completely too early. It's as if we have cinema before you have D.W. Griffiths, and the next thing you have Spider-Man 7, and there's nothing in the middle. And it feels like we've sort of raced through to a kind of decadent, repetitive period without this sort of creative flourishing you had in the middle. And I noticed that my kids are both gamers, and they, everything you can immediately categorize, you know, oh, it's an FPS, it's an on-rail shooter, it's a Japanese RPG, it's sort of sandbox with, you know, sandbox with narrative elements, but you don't have to play them, and it's got an online mode, you know, and there's never a game they're struggling to describe because it feels so new. And that's the thing that's really disappointing. In this very new medium, it's as if all these genres have already become kind of locked down.
Yeah, I always think that was a really interesting thing when, in that era where games were much more interesting, that you'd play the first level and you wouldn't quite know what to do. And I found that very alienating, disorienting. And actually, the first level of Bioshock is a bit like that. You just don't know what the rules are. And it's like experimental fiction in that sense. But we have now got to the stage where you know that you're going to have X number of weapons and this and that, and, you know, and actually the time limit is a fake time limit. It's just lots of people shouting at you, and you've got as much time to get through the burning building as you want and all that kind of stuff. I just feel so disappointed because it was something that really meant quite a lot to me at one time, and I've just, and now I say I play Far Cry 5 because I enjoy sniping people from a really long distance away. It makes me feel quite accomplished in life. But
everybody loves a sniping mission.
Right, okay, that's good. It's not just me, because it is... It just makes me always think about the line in, I think it's Terry Pratchett's Men at Arms, where he talks about them all picking up weapons from the armoury, and Corporal Nobbs picks a pike, because he says the crucial thing about a pike is that everything happens at the other end of it, i.e. a long way away.
It's very good. That, I mean, it's the thing about the games are so like work, you know, the modern game, and things like, even the word inventory management, it makes you want to go and have a lie down, you know, and it's astonishing that that's a kind of core part of how you get through these things. I mean, that's the other thing about them, apart from the whole blockbusterization, is that it is bizarre that you spend all day, every day, sitting at a keyboard in front of a screen, doing repetitive, demanding tasks against a time-managed framework for which you get kind of measured rewards, and then you go and play a game in which you do repetitive managed tasks in front of a screen, blah blah blah. I mean, that's properly odd, that as we're looking at the other side of the monitor, you wouldn't know whether someone is, you know, shooting people in the face or filling out an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, I think Naomi Alderman said it'd be like having a novel where in order to read chapter two you have to answer a quiz on chapter one. Right, the idea that you're just not... Well, actually, Far Cry is very nice to you. If you died terribly, which I do frequently, then it just subtly makes it a lot easier for you. So that has cheered me up. And also, I got to watch an elk fight a cougar.
That would have been quite fun. Actually, having said that everything's repetitive and boring, there is that thing. I can't play it because they're too difficult. And it is a thing that's interesting in games about difficulty and about the people, gamers liking difficulty. I know it's not quite the same as what we mean by difficulty in fiction or the other arts, but it is quite striking that it's the youngest medium and it's both the one where the audience most prizes difficulty. I think there is something quite new about those catastrophically difficult things like Dead Souls, where, you know, you'll be lured in and then you die and you have to start again from the beginning. And those roguelike games, which are designedly kind of random and mad and impossibly hard. I mean, that it doesn't appeal to me much, but when I look at them, I do think, okay, that is a bit new.
Yeah, I think that's a kind of a young person's game, isn't it? Because that's what you do when you've got time sort of yawns out before you, and you've got, you know, you and your friends have got a project, basically.
That's what you do when you know for a fact that you're never going to die.
Yeah, after the age of 21, suddenly you think, I actually quite like sleep. Sweet sleep's quite fun. John Ashton, thank you so much for joining us. The book is The Wall, and it is out now.
Thank you very much, Helen.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and my co-host, Stephen Bush, recorded by India Book and produced by Nick Hilton. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra. Why not subscribe to the New Statesman? Stephen needs new shoes. I need new shoes. We all need new shoes.
Thank you. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.